Hello, I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and welcome to Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. Tonight on Health Matters, we will highlight some of the important research that is taking place here at LSU Health Science Center here in Shreveport. We will discuss the process of transforming important breakthroughs in biomedical research into clinical realities and discuss the emerging roles of innovation and the university industry partnerships that develop in effectively transforming basic science and technological advancements into public health measures that can improve both our economy as well as community health. Let's go ahead and meet our guest tonight.
Hello, my name is Andrew Urochko. I'm a professor at the Health Sciences Center.
Hello, Dr. Urochko.
And I am Chris Kevel. I'm also a professor at the LSU Health Sciences Center and the director of the Cardiovascular Center up there.
All right. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And to our listeners out there, this is Health Matters Tonight. And as you know, this is a live show where you can call and ask a question about our topic tonight. Our topic tonight is basic science research as well as clinical science research. You might also call that translational research. And you can call and ask a question at 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Urochko, tell us a little bit about your background, if you will. You know, what brought you to where you are today in terms of your career as a basic scientist?
So I was originally from Virginia. I was at Virginia Tech. I got a undergraduate degree there and a bachelor's of science in biochemistry, and I guess I've always enjoyed aspects of research. I then went on and stayed at Virginia Tech, got a PhD there, and then did a research fellowship at the Lineberger Comprehensive Cancer Center at the University of North Carolina, again looking at aspects of science research. I've done work on immunology, studying the immune system and how aberrations in the immune response are associated with various diseases, particularly inflammatory diseases, aspects of heart disease. And then I moved into host-pathogen interactions with a specific focus on infectious viruses, where I am continuing to work on here at the Health Sciences Center, looking at a virus called human cytomegalovirus, which has certainly been in the news a lot recently.
All right, we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go forward in the show. Let's go ahead and talk to Dr. Kevel briefly. Dr. Kevel, what brought you to where you are today in terms of your career as a basic scientist and an entrepreneur, from what I understand?
Yeah. So I'm originally a native of Shreveport and did my undergraduate down in Natchitoches at the Northwestern State University, and came back to LSU and did my PhD in molecular and cellular physiology, and then went on to the University of Alabama in Birmingham and did fellowship training in genomics and pathology. And of course, the area has always had a historic, strong role in pathology and physiology throughout the nation in terms of their research, and had the opportunity to come back and have then established my laboratory that studied mechanisms of cardiovascular disease, in particular how blood vessels grow or don't grow depending upon the different cardiovascular disorders that exist. And that then through a long process influenced a lot of the technology transfer that we did in my laboratory out into the private sector. But along the way, I also worked with leadership at the Health Science Center to help develop the Cardiovascular Center, the new Center for Cardiovascular Diseases and Sciences, and then even very recently have been assigned and appointed the Vice Chancellor for Research up at LSU Health Science Center to begin efforts to stimulate translational research.
Well, congratulations. That sounds like a very important endeavor for the Science Center to be undertaking at this time.
Thank you.
Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. We are talking about clinical as well as basic science research as it applies to health conditions. So, Dr. Urochko, you mentioned that you worked in immunology. What drew, you know, if you were going to explain, let's say, to a high school sophomore or junior who's thinking about a career in science, how would you describe to them how your research works in terms of studying the immune system?
Well, obviously, there's many different aspects of the immune system you can study. I think it's a fascinating and certainly understood or I guess not completely understood process, and it's really central to most aspects of disease. You heard Dr. Kevel talk about cardiovascular disease. I mentioned that there's a certain element of aberrant or abnormal aspects of the immune response. Certainly with my specialty in infectious viruses, we know that many of the viruses that are pathogenic that we consider at least as human pathogens are ones that are, or their aspects of pathogenesis are associated with alterations in immune response. The immune response doesn't recognize these various pathogens, and obviously we've heard many viruses in the news recently, and in almost all cases, aspects of how the immune response recognizes them, how it deals with it, ultimately results in whether that patient might resolve the infection or in some cases get persistent or chronic type infections, obviously leading to long-term disease in some of these patients. So I guess to answer your question, for me, the immune response was interesting because it's a central tenet of much of our health for, in any regards to a pathogen, whether it's a virus, bacteria, and that was sort of a fascinating area to think about. And even as far as in high school and elementary school, middle school, when they would put blood droplets on a slide and you can see things moving in there, to me that was always a fun thing to look at, and I guess it piqued my interest from a very early time of my development to be associated with you know, understanding this aspect. And like I said, I sort of moved from just the immune response to interactions and how it's associated with pathogens and disease.
Yeah, so you mentioned seeing things move on a slide, you probably weren't seeing viruses. So the difference between you know, just basically, what's the difference between a virus? Is a virus a cell, or is it a, how close is it, closer to a human cell than a bacterium is? Explain to us, if you will, what a virus actually is compared to, say, a bacterial organism.
Well, a virus, I guess, in a lot of ways, it's a more simple or a simpler form of life. It's an obligate parasite in the sense that it has to be inside something. So, in answer your question, at least in a simple sense, it's obviously less than a cell, since it must be inside a cell in order to replicate. And that's really a hallmark of all the viruses when we think about whether they're pathogens, the humans, animals. These are entities. Some would call them alive, some don't call them alive, but there's certainly some sort of simple life form that requires a host always for its own process. Certainly they have different ones, have different stages. Some can only live in humans, some can live outside of us for a while where they're dormant to be picked up at a later date. But in all cases, they are required, or they require a cell, a human, an animal, or some other creature as the host.
So what makes a, you know, you mentioned the immune response, and so I understand viruses are ubiquitous, right? So what makes a virus cause illness? What makes one virus, let's say, for example, Zika, or Ebola or HIV pathogenic to humans, and other viruses sort of are just along for the ride and don't necessarily cause human disease or even in animals? Is there one specific trait of a virus that makes it pathogenic? Is it the host's immune response to the virus that makes the virus a pathogen, or is it the virus, the makeup of the virus itself?
In many cases, it's a more complex answer than there's not really a simple answer, but in a lot of cases, those viruses that have lived with us for a long time and on the order of, you know, millions of years have generally evolved a process by which they live with us and they want to keep the host healthy. If you think of any of the viruses that are generally, they can cause disease in some hosts but not an average one. So the virus I study, cytomegalovirus, generally 80 to 90% of us have it. It does depend on where you are in the world. Numbers do vary. But for the most part, it's very benign, and it's evolved to live with us, to spread from host to host, not to cause disease, although there are very serious consequences under some circumstances. Viruses like Zika, you mentioned, certainly are in the news. And this is really a new pathogen that we haven't seen as humans. And I think when they're sort of newer in that sense, the damage they cause is oftentimes considered greater simply because it hasn't really learned to work with us. I know it sounds in a sense like it wants to be our friend or a partner, and that's not really what I mean, but in many cases that is true. A virus that doesn't cause a lot of disease has a better and easier chance to spread from host to host. While one, as we know, smallpox would be an example of one that was extremely deadly virus, and because of its danger and then a mortality it caused, it's now a virus that's certainly been eradicated around the world. Another good one is certainly polio, where their goal is to eradicate in 2018. In fact, my uncle was involved with the polio vaccine many, many years ago. And that's one that did cause significant disease and one that, you know, obviously I said we're trying to eradicate, but it was, I don't know if you consider it an ancient virus in that sense. So I hope that sort of answered your question a little bit.
Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your calls or comments, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Kelwell, I'm going to ask you a question that's maybe not quite so granular. That seems to be a popular word in the media these days, a little bit granular with our discussion of viruses. So how do you find the funding to actually do research? Let's just say you have a great idea, you want to bring a product to market, you want to help patients out eventually, but the money has to come from somewhere. Where does money most often come from?
Yeah, so that's a great question, and it's one that isn't easy to give a straightforward answer to, in the sense that there's what we call a public and a private sector. In the public sector, which really is, say, for example, LSU, all of the faculty write for grants, and these grants are submitted to organizations like the National Institutes of Health, as well as the National Science Foundation, or they could be submitted to other organizations such as the American Heart Association or the American Diabetes Association. And those grants are instrumental in providing the money that's needed to test out hypotheses. And the idea here is that the investigators come up with a new idea, a groundbreaking discovery, things of that nature, that then they can put together in a proposal that then goes to one of these agencies, and the agencies then give them an award. These are actually won. Grant, I think, is somewhat of a misconception, because it's not just you write it and you get it automatically. You have to win these grants, so they're awards.
So you don't get your degree and your diploma comes with a blank check to go ahead and do your research.
No, we wish.
Oh, yeah, we truly do wish for that.
Exactly.
And so you're always in the hunt. You're always competing with other faculty at other institutions throughout the United States. So it's a really competitive environment. That being said, it's also very exciting, because when you're in the laboratory doing research, you're on the cutting edge is where you want to be. So that's one component, the public funding. Oftentimes, the public funding helps get the idea mature enough to where you can have reasonable data, reasonable conclusions, and in fact, a real discovery, hopefully, that then can become application for a patent, for example. So this now then allows an individual or an institution, say for example like LSU, to file a patent application that could be licensed to the private sector. So the private sector is a critical partner in passing the baton of scientific discovery from the public sector and allowing it to go through the process of realization to an actual product, for example. And in that regard, there's a whole nother gauntlet, if you will, of raising money, which involves everything from angel funds to venture capital to, in the end, partnership with a major multinational company that has, you know, purposes and funds dedicated to do that.
Let's go ahead and take our first caller for the evening. We have Brian on the line. Brian, thank you for calling Health Matters tonight.
Sure, no worries. I have a question for both the scientists, and it's about access to information. for members of the general public. I'm just wondering, would they please maybe recommend publications that the general public can go to that are reliable, that have research in them that has been conducted, or screened at least by peer-reviewed academic journals? I feel it's important nowadays for us to have access to reliable information. But I don't know where to go, apart from having access to peer-reviewed academic journals, which the average person doesn't have. I just wonder, are they aware of any publications that they would personally recommend as being somewhat reliable?
Yeah, so I think we both, that's a great question.
Absolutely.
And it's one that right now in the field of research, and I don't want to pigeonhole it to biomedical, it's all research, it's coming under the realization that information does need to be available and distributed to the public. So in the context of what are some good places or good sources out there, there is one open access is what it's called in the field, journal called PLOS One, PLOS One, and these this is an initiative that was born out of federal regulations to make in a federally sponsored research open access. And then there's also other entities such as Frontiers, which is, if you look at the Frontiers of Science on website, you can go to that as terms of a publisher. They have many open access manuscripts. And in fact, if you go through the website, you can really Google open access, and you'll be able to see that many different periodicals are creating open access journals that are available to the public.
I think one of the key features is, and you brought up a good point, is how do you get the journals that are peer-reviewed? And there's a lot of these predatory journals out there now that anyone can publish in. For me, at least, and I think for Dr. Kevel as well, there's a site through NIH called PubMed. And if you use PubMed, and you can search, for example, in our fields of immunology, vascular biology, pathogen biology, anything that I would search will only pull up journals that are really certified peer-reviewed journals, and it generally would not ever pull up one of these predatory journals where basically people can publish anything as long as they pay money. And I think if you're trying to find real information about an interesting or perhaps some illness or some disease or something that you might have heard of, maybe you have, you want to learn more, I think that's a great way to do it, using something like PubMed, which is through NIH. Other aspects, certainly CDC and NIH proper have some good resources to check that are certainly peer-reviewed and in essence are reasonably verified as being legitimate scientific and medical documents with the correct information.
Excellent question.
Very much, yeah, both of you guys. I'm driving, so I'll have to hang up and try and write that down as quickly as possible.
All right.
To just recap, like, in 5 seconds, what were one of them was called PubMed?
PubMed is a website that's, that's really through NIH.
And then the other gentleman, I'm sorry, I've forgotten his name, recommended.
There's one called PLOS. It's PLOS One. And there's also Frontiers.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed. It's been a pleasure.
Brian, thank you. And you can download the podcast or listen to the show online at your convenience after the show. So thank you so much for calling us.
All right, great. Thank you, guys. Appreciate
you know, what a good question, you know, especially now seems like we're entering a post-truth era in our culture where science is relative, and it's science is supposed to be sort of a bedrock, right? Mm-hmm. And it's like if you have a website, you can publish, and your information is automatically legitimized. Does that affect you and the scientific community? Obviously, it's affecting the other parts of our culture significant ways.
It has dramatic effects. Yeah. I mean, I can speak from a vaccine side. We hear all the information out there on aspects, side effects of vaccines from autism and so forth. And a lot of people really don't happen to go forth and look for the real information. and it does affect people's ability to then make a rational decision if they've got the wrong information. They may or may not vaccinate based on incorrect information. And we see all the time with the flu and these other vaccine preventable diseases, people not vaccinated because of false information. Unfortunately, in many cases, or in sad cases, there's mortalities associated with the lack of vaccination. I mean, flu is just certainly one example, but it's not the only one.
And just to echo that, it really does muddy the waters. In fact, there's other examples, say, for example, cardiovascular disease. There's some claims that different for-profit companies will make that aren't based off of empirical studies or evidence or data, and oftentimes they pass that off or publish that online as something that is, you know, peer-reviewed and validated through studies, when indeed it hasn't occurred. So it can be very difficult.
Let's go ahead to our next caller of the evening. We have Karen from Shreveport. Karen, thank you so much for calling Health Matters tonight.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to know if you could comment as to why nutritional supplements and performance-enhancing supplements do not undergo the type of scientific research that regular medications would undergo. These are very interesting. There's so many on the market, but it's a little bit scary as a consumer to know what I might be taking and could it be harmful.
Sure. That's a great question, Karen, and in fact, it's one that we see in some of the cardiovascular aspects of medicine. The first part of the answer to your question is that nutraceutical or nutritional, I should say, products are not subject to the same FDA stringent review criteria and guidelines that other pharmaceuticals are. That has been a major issue in the field, and both pharma companies have been upset about it. Medical practitioners have been upset about it. Researchers have been upset about it. So there is actually efforts now through the FDA to really begin to hold nutrition companies, manufacturers, to their claims, to provide evidence and data that this is indeed a good product. And again, that kind of gets to the crux of buyer beware. But to give you the second answer to the question, there are actually a lot of companies that are doing nutrition-based research, and that information is out there. And if you can see where they actually cite a publication, and then you can go to PubMed, for example, which Dr. Urochko just mentioned, that's good, because that means now that study has undergone peer review and suggests that at least there's some validity or veracity to that claim. Again, they don't have to go through the FDA to get their drug approved, so as long as they had a clinical trial and they got positive results, most of the time some of these companies will just run straight to the market. But unfortunately, that's kind of the state we're in right now.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. We really appreciate you calling into Health Matters tonight. Again, this is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. The number for your calls for questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. So the two questions so far that we've had from callers, it does sort of have to do with, you know, the dissemination of research findings. And so How does that normally take place? So we talked about getting the research funded. And so, Dr. Urochko, from your perspective, you know, what did you see as you were getting your experience in research? How did you get your work, you know, recognized and actually published? How does a basic scientist present their work to the public?
So there's a number of avenues to present your work to the public. Sort of the first step, obviously, after getting funded, and Dr. Kevel and I both have National Institutes of Health grants. So, for example, a student in my laboratory, they'll be doing work on what we have proposed in the grant. And the avenue by which they would then present the work to the public usually starts with local meetings, for example, at the Health Sciences Center or around maybe Shreveport, local ones within the state of Louisiana. And then we would generally go to national, international meetings where we present our work prior to any peer review of the manuscript to sort of our peers within the field in a more casual environment where they might have a poster and people would ask questions. You might present a talk at a national meeting, and you would try to disseminate your information that way. Again, it's not peer-reviewed at that point, but it is reviewed, in essence, by your peers while you're talking or presenting a poster. When you feel your data is strong enough, and that comes from your training, you would then present, write a manuscript following your own discipline, or some. There's certainly some journals. We talked about PubMed that are cross-discipline. You would write up your journal in a format that's appropriate for that particular medical journal or scientific journal, and then you would submit it. Obviously, it's much easier now with online submissions via the internet as opposed to the old days when it had to actually be mailed and photographs taken. And it's sent out there for peer review from 2, 3, 4, 5 different colleagues. These are anonymous reviews, so you know, they're obviously reviewing the validity, the veracity of the science using their expertise. After a period of time, 2, 3, 4, 5 weeks, depending on the journal, you get that back with questions, comments, suggestions. Hopefully, if you've done a good job initially, they tell you what it needs to do to get published. In some cases, unfortunately, for ones that may be less valid, or maybe not valid is not the right word, but they don't feel it's stringent enough, the data can get rejected. Assuming everything goes well, you make your corrections. That might involve more experiments, it might involve more research, some intellectual research, etc., and you'd eventually send it back, and it goes out for publication in a number of journals unique to your discipline, or like I said, ones that are across disciplines. And some of the top ones for us, we certainly hope to get high impact journals that are recognized by your peers across your discipline and across multiple disciplines.
You know, Dr. Kevel, along those same lines, we talked about funding. And so is there an interaction between funding source and publication? I know in my area, you know, there's, you know, in clinical research, there's something called publication bias, right? Mm-hmm. So is there an interaction between funding sources such as the NIH, you know, National Institutes of Health? Is there an interaction between the sources of funding and actual publication of data where... If you're funded by a certain entity, is it required that your data is published?
Yes. Yeah.
So
well,
if you could speak a little bit about that.
In terms of required that your data is published, that's not so crystallized, if you will. But NIH does require that when you publish data from government-sponsored research, that be available so the public can get it and consume it. The way that NIH and actually other funding agencies, say in Europe or parts of Japan, for example, have engaged publishers such as Elsevier. I've worked with them as an editor for several years, and Elsevier realizes as a publisher it's a important responsibility to humanity to make sure the data is out there and available. And that way, as long as there is the ability to pay for that being out there, this information is disseminated. So it's not as if there's a direct line between the funding agency and the publisher. There's the obligation and the expectation that will be published and made available to the public.
And one thing I'll just add, what Dr. Kevel just discussed and we talked to our first caller about, is when we publish our work, and it's sponsored by NIH, as we mentioned, since it's taxpayer dollars, they want to have this information disseminated to the public. Whether I publish in a specific journal or not, my manuscript goes to NIH for an open access via PubMed that anyone could get to. So if I publish in an infectious disease journal, maybe only myself, universities, those who get a subscription can see that journal. But the part that's open access does go to NIH. It's not as pretty in the sense it's not all typeset like the journal, but it is open up with all the data, the actual writing, the actual text, all the figures, as you would see in the journal, are open to all the public. And this stems from the, as we just said, the idea that humanity, or at least in this case the U.S., since their taxpayers are paying for NIH, have access to all the information that we do publish.
In terms of, you know, let's say if private institutions are funding research, is there a requirement that their data is actually published as well?
That's a good question. And the answer to that is no, there isn't a requirement that that information be published. And in fact, knowing several colleagues that are in, say, for example, pharmaceutical sectors, they're very meticulous and they have essentially libraries of information. Now, mind you, that is mostly for development of drugs and therapeutics, but there isn't an obligation there.
And what about sources that are philanthropic, you know, foundational funding sources? Are there requirements in terms of accountability back to the funding source in those situations? I think you mentioned the National Science Foundation as one of the initial entities that funds research, but American Diabetes Association, for example, or other agencies, American Heart, that fund research. Are there requirements to publish data in those? Mm-hmm. And those are tax privileged institutions, right?
So right.
Are there obligations for their data to be published?
Yes. Yes. And it depends. For example, both Dr. Rajko and I work with American Heart extensively, and I also work with American Diabetes. For example, with American Diabetes, they want to make sure that the publications that come from the funds that they distribute or disperse to individuals is out there and available to the public. So it is part of their criteria and their metric.
Correct.
And I know I'm hammering publishing here for some reason. I don't know why, but maybe it's because I've worked hard to get things published. I know how difficult it is.
So exactly.
I admire that process so much. I mean, you think that there's just volumes of publications out there, but these researchers work really hard to get this stuff published. Before we move on, Dr. Urochko, if you could speak, how important is it actually to present negative data? So let's just say we're looking at a virus. We want to cure a disease that's caused by the virus. We test a drug and it doesn't work. Is that important information for the public to know and other scientists to know?
Ultimately, it's very important. I mean, positive and negative still gives us an answer. In the context of drug design, obviously negative means that's not an approach that's working, and you're going to have to take some different approach. And unfortunately, in many cases, when you have antivirals and use them against disease, it's always a bad outcome for the company for that. But as a scientist, it tells us that that mechanism, the part that it targets against a virus, is not something in a human that's working. And that might be because it's not a good area in a human to work. It might tell us that the drug itself has some failings in its bioavailability, et cetera, that in itself might be something that leads us to the clue to make it better. So negative data, although seemingly less informative, I think can be just as informative.
So for a scientist, it's just another branch in the process that you're going through in terms of your inquiry of the process.
Correct, but ultimately positive data is what really gets you excited, is what really gets your papers published, since we've already discussed that, because that's a new idea. But ultimately negative information is important to disseminate for the reasons we've discussed.
This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and we are talking about science tonight, basic science as well as clinical science. You can call and ask a question of one of our researchers here from LSU here in Shreveport. The number for your questions is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Our guests tonight include Dr. Andrew Urochko. He is a professor of microbiology and immunology here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Chris Kevel. He is the director of the Center for Cardiovascular Diseases and Sciences, also here at LSU in Shreveport. Again, the number for your calls, 1-800-552-8502. Dr. Kevel, if you will, tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now in your lab and what where that's going.
Sure. So my laboratory studies blood vessel health and blood vessel development. One of the things that we've been really interested over the years is this process known as angiogenesis, which is essentially blood vessel growth. In our bodies, we have numerous blood vessels throughout the whole body. And in fact, many individuals consider it to be an organ into itself because the all organs are dependent upon them. And so what we've been interested in particular is how blood vessels and their functions are regulated during diseases such as peripheral arterial disease, which is a disease of blood vessels, say, for example, in the limb that causes a lack of blood flow to the limb. And we've looked at ways to try to stimulate blood flow back to the limb by stimulating blood vessels to grow and undergo what's called remodeling so that they reroute themselves around the blockage, if you will, almost akin to what you would do if you were trying to avoid an accident on the interstate. And we've really been excited about that because it's led to the discovery of several approaches to intervene on a therapeutic level that hopefully one day will have an impact in patients' lives.
What do you see in terms of the future clinical applicability of this research?
The future of it that we've discovered is really quite wide open. In fact, in my laboratory, we filed for several patents that I've been in the process of being issued. Some of them have issued, some are on the way. And there have been several clinical trials that we've done. We've done a phase one clinical trial in collaboration with Pennington Research Institute down in Baton Rouge, and then also done several phase two clinical trials. And looking at the ability for this drug to stimulate new blood vessel growth and restore blood flow to ischemic limbs of patients with diabetes that have peripheral arterial disease. And so in those phase 2A trials, which is a preliminary phase 2 trial, the drug was safe, and more importantly, it showed signs of biological effectiveness, which was great. And we even learned new things that the drug would be good for, such as reducing pain in diabetic individuals, which actually, when you think about it, makes sense because oftentimes the pain that's experienced in the limbs of diabetics is because they can't get blood flow to those nerves, and so the nerves become what's called hypoxic, and they fire and they cause pain. So there's a lot of options and a lot of applicability for this drug moving forward.
So you mentioned a couple of things, and I'm going to back up just a little bit. You mentioned phases of research. Mm-hmm. And so for some of our listeners out there, these may be new terms for them. So when you mention phase 1, phase 2, phase 2A, phase 2B, and so forth, I know there's phase 3 and phase 4. Mm-hmm. Explain, if you will, you know, what a phase 1 research study is, and then what phase 2 and phase 3 are.
Sure. So you're right. And drug discovery, we've been talking a lot about basic science, but once you've been able to take something and then pull it out into the clinical sector, there's a whole another layer of series of steps to make sure that the intervention or the therapy you're testing is effective. And there are really five phases. The last phase is kind of a post-approval analysis phase, the fifth phase. But the phases 1 through 4 are a series of processes where the FDA requires you in a very systematic manner to test the compound or test the drug so that it can be eventually, hopefully, approved as a therapeutic. A phase 1 really is essentially a safety and dosing study where you essentially take subjects that are either healthy or normal, and you give them the drug one time so you can see how does it metabolize or how's it cleared in the body. And you can also monitor individuals for signs of side effects. And then from there, if everything looks good, you can move to a phase 2 trial. And typically the phase 2 trial is now trying to push the envelope a little bit more. You may have, in the phase 1 trial, given just one or two doses. You may want to give more doses in a phase 2 trial. You may want to look at biological efficacy to see, are there any biological effects that we think should be happening because the drug was targeted for something? And does it merit moving forward to a phase three? When you hit a phase three trial, that's where it really gets, it gets down to the brass tacks. This is where you have a multi-center large trial that usually oftentimes has hundreds if not thousands of patients that really do look at hard clinical endpoints to see whether this drug is really going to be very effective for the disease that it's being used. And phase four is really an extension of that and gets even bigger with the eventual application of a new drug to the FDA.
So basically, so if the drug is developed, let's say, in an animal model or in the laboratory, it'll go to phase one and two, looking at safety first.
Yes.
Safety first, and then, safety as first. You mentioned, brass tacks becomes more of the efficacy issue mm-hmm. that's studied in disease processes. Mm-hmm. All right, this is listener-supported Red River Radio. We are talking about clinical and basic science. The number for your questions, it's 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet a question at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Urochko, what's going on in your lab today?
So I work on a virus called human cytomegalovirus, and although probably most people haven't really heard about it, it's the leading infectious cause of birth defects in the United States and other Western countries. And it's really come to the news recently with Zika, where we hear about microcephaly and birth defects. But CMV has been around, obviously, much longer, and it's given us an avenue to think about not just Zika, but all these viruses that are associated with birth defects. But numbers we see with CMV are much, much greater than anything so far we've seen with Zika virus, with somewhere around perhaps as many as 40,000 babies every year born in the United States associated with some aspect of congenital infection. Not all show obvious symptoms that we think of as the worst case scenario, but nevertheless, it's obviously a significant issue with somewhere between 0.5 and 1% of all live births being associated with CMV or congenital infection. The other important aspect that we're also interested in is it's a leading or one of the leading infectious complications following organ, solid organ transplantation or bone marrow transplantation. And the numbers are astounding when you look at them, with about 30% of all solid organ transplantations coming down with CMV syndrome and more than 80% of all bone marrow transplant patients showing evidence of CMV disease. There's also associations with heart disease, which is my link with Dr. Kevel, and the vascular components, where it's associated with aspects of inflammatory disease, vascular inflammatory disease. So this is a virus sort of with a funny name that was often most people don't think about, but one that is associated with a number of very serious and significant issues in the immunocompromised as well in healthy individuals.
So if you're we're going to explain this virus, to a science class in the 11th or 12th grade. How is it classified? It's a cytomegalovirus. Is it a virus that's similar to, say, herpes, or is it more similar to a cold virus? What sort of virus classification would you
So
get?
This virus is in the herpes virus family, and I know whenever you say herpes virus, everyone thinks of the commercials that are on late at night with I've got herpes and I don't want my partner to have it, in the Valtrex commercials. But there are 8 different family members in the herpes virus family, and everyone certainly have heard of chickenpox is another one to say this is really a diverse family. And cytomegalovirus is one of the more serious ones in regard to some of the diseases. But we do have virus in this family, from those that cause oral and genital lesions to chickenpox to viruses that are associated with various cancers. And then cytomegalovirus, which is, as I've already mentioned, a significant issue in during congenital infection, or if a baby were to be infected in utero, as well as transplant patients and vascular disease.
Now, is the virus something that is a seasonal virus, sort of like a, you know, like cold viruses, or is it something that you can get any time of year?
So this is a virus that you would get any time of the year. It's generally spread in any body fluid a male or female makes. Generally, it was considered a salivary gland virus, and that's its prominent mechanism of dissemination from host to host, although it is also a sexually transmitted virus as well.
So you can get it any time of year. And what happens to a normal host when they encounter this virus?
For the most part, if you were a healthy individual, if children often shed it, maybe you hadn't seen it before, mom or dad, you would just show typical flu-like symptoms of fever, depending on some people have rashes, et cetera. But for the most part, it would be a nondescript viral type illness of anywhere from a couple of days, perhaps to a couple of weeks. And that would, for the most part, be it. It's really in these immunocompromised patients, so primary infection in a baby in utero, developing embryo, primary infection in transplant patients are the significant issues.
And so once an individual gets this mild flu-like illness and they get better, does the virus stay around? You know, like shingles, for example, is reactivation of the chickenpox virus, right? Or,
correct.
You know, these herpes viruses, herpes type 1, you know, comes out to the lip typically, and you can get reactivation of that. So the virus presumably becomes active again. Is that what happens with cytomegalovirus as well?
Absolutely. So this is a virus that once you get it, goes latent or remains with that host for life. And this particular virus, it goes latent in the bone marrow. And that's associated with aspects of the disease I mentioned, particularly in transplant patients.
Okay, so once you get it, you've got it.
Absolutely.
So is there any hope or plans for a vaccine? You know, for a vaccine for this virus, because I know we've talked about on the show before another virus, I believe in a similar family, the human papillomavirus. You know, we have a new vaccine for that, but it's a vaccine that, you know, causes cancer. And that's one of the newer vaccines that's come out. There's also the shingles vaccine that's out. Are there any plans to have a vaccination developed for the cytomegalovirus?
So they've been looking for a vaccine and trying to work on developing one for a long time. So far, the only success in the herpes family, as you've mentioned, is Varivax and Zostervax. So Varivax being the vaccine for given to children to prevent chickenpox, and Zostervax given to generally people over 50 to prevent shingles, generally 60, I guess, but anywhere over 50 is okay. The complexities of human cytomegalovirus have proven rather difficult, making so far at least a vaccine. There's been essentially a failed vaccine to date. Some of the issues are probably associated with the fact there's probably many, many different strains, much more than we've probably previously thought, and that's proven to be extremely difficult. But you're absolutely right. A vaccine would be wonderful to give it to young women, men, prior to choosing to have children, prevent the devastating illnesses seen. Certainly would be useful in transplant patients prior to transplantation, at least under some circumstances. But at present, there's no vaccine, and the antivirals that are currently available are rather have a lot of toxic side effects, and it is very difficult to treat this virus.
So in terms of you're working with issues regarding this virus in pregnancy, and I know we're getting a little bit clinical, so you know, you're certainly welcome to defer if you need to, but I'm thinking you probably won't need to. But from the standpoint of a pregnant woman, let's say that we have pregnant women listening to the show right now about cytomegalovirus and the effects the in utero fetus, what would be a consideration for a normal pregnancy with a woman who's probably been exposed to this virus, correct? Most people have, right?
Most people have, but the real issue in most cases seems to be a new primary infection.
Okay.
So the best thing a pregnant woman would really want to do is just be careful with hygiene. So there is a number of states, to give some examples of where they're trying to go with it, they would like to have more testing to give examples to women and more knowledge from the OBs to talk to their pregnant patients about CMV. And this has really been an issue with CMV being, as I've mentioned, leading cause of birth defects, but it's really, as a leading cause, it's one of the least known agent to affect a pregnant woman and obviously her baby. And the studies that are out there show there's a 20 to 50% decrease in transmission from mother to intrauterine transmission by simply good hygiene, washing hands, not sharing cups, bowls, food items with younger children. As we've joked many times, my wife and I, and I'm sure everyone else on this show, that children are little bags of bugs. And the same thing holds true with this virus. So being careful for the first 6, 8, 6-8 or so months, obviously, you could be, it'd be advantageous to be careful the entire pregnancy term, but most of the damage does seem to be from prior to conception infection to about 6 months post-conception. But like I said, there are studies saying 20 to 50% decrease in transmission, intrauterine transmission, if you simply are careful washing your hands, being careful not to share with children and other things. So that really tells us transmission during pregnancy is a significant issue.
So are women actually able to go and be tested to see if they've ever been exposed to CME once they learn that they are pregnant?
Absolutely. You can go. I made my wife get tested. It's not a universal. Obviously, I had to pay out of pocket. It was not covered by insurance. Three states have already passed laws to start doing screening, obviously, in this particular case, post-birth, to see if there's interdiction to have a better outcome for babies that are born. But you can be screened prior to that. The big point they're trying to make for women is knowledge. So having OBs discuss these issues with the women, obviously the husband as well, as far as a family, on issues that can be done to prevent transmission.
And is it possible to have, let's say a woman was exposed when she was a child, she becomes pregnant. Is it possible, like in the cancer patient or the bone marrow patient, to have the virus reactivated during pregnancy and affect the fetus in that way?
Absolutely. Reactivation is certainly an issue. There's a number of different ideas out right now, from some cases being due to reactivation of latent virus in a pregnant woman. Other ideas are there's actually new primary infections, and this is one of the reasons, getting back to the vaccine, there might be many, many strains and people might be continually exposed to new virus. And there's certainly some intriguing data done in countries that have high sero prevalence, for example, in Brazil, which seem to have the same rate of congenital infection as we have here, and yet we really have, at about the age when women would be likely to have children, about a 50% seropositivity, suggesting it is actually new infections or continual reinfections that might be associated with disease. Again, of course, reactivation is also always an issue and one that shouldn't be discounted.
So it seems to me as maybe the CMV virus doesn't confer you as much lifelong immunity as some other scenarios may once you have it. Is it possible to catch a different strain of it and you may not necessarily have immunity to it? Or is if
Correct.
You get it again, is it always reactivation, or you can get it either way?
No, you can get what would be apparently different strains. To say you don't have lifelong immunity, I'm not sure that's entirely correct. You certainly have lifelong immunity to the virus you have, and it likely gives you protection such that the next ones are less severe. The issue always is the developing baby, of course, is a brand new host, and that's the real issue in the context of congenital infection. Mama is a mature host that has an immune response if she's seen it or not seen it, but the baby is always a naive host.
And so probably the amount of viremia in a new infection is much higher, and there's probably more placental transfer in those situations compared to reactivation, I'm assuming?
That's one possible scenario, although there are some interesting studies showing that placental viremia does not seem to correlate. So if you obviously do amnio and look for virus, there are certainly in this case babies showing high placental viremia that may not show overt or at really any symptoms, others with low, so it suggests it's not just viral load, but there might be some other issues that ultimately are what cause susceptible or some children to have the severe disease that we see, some to the less, the hearing loss, and some can show signs of congenital infection with no observable disease, even for as long as they follow them for dozens and dozens of years.
So, yeah, you mentioned hearing loss. Just briefly, what are some of the other issues that infants may have that are infected with the virus?
So the most common is hearing loss, and the most severe is what we hear very common with Zika, is the microcephaly. Unfortunately, in a sad way, there's only a few ways to damage the brain, and during development, if the brain doesn't develop right, since hydrostatic pressure allows the skull to increase, when you lose that pressure doing damage to the various developing brain tissue, you don't get normal skull development. So that's the most severe issues of disease.
Hey, Dr. Kevel, in the few couple of minutes that we have left, from your perspective, from where you are, and we appreciate your contributions that you've made to LSU so far, and this new position for you will present opportunities and challenges, I'm thinking. So what do you see in terms of the future in the way research is going from the basic science standpoint and universities such as LSU here? I know that's that's a big question I'd give you like 60 seconds to answer.
Right. Well, the one thing I'll say is to some of your listeners out there, just yesterday, the Senate passed a piece of legislation at the federal level called the 21st Century Cures Act. And this is actually fantastic. In fact, in many ways, a long time in coming. Funding for basic science research and even clinical research has been at some of the historic lows in this country that we have seen over the past decade. And everyone on both sides of the aisle has realized that this has been a significant detriment to our endeavor of biomedical research. Our country has led the way in biomedical research and still continues to do that, but there's a lot of others that are on our coattails, and they're investing a lot of money. So the 21st Century Cures Act has the Moonshot Project in it for cancer and has many other things such as precision medicine. And that translates back down to LSU and to the citizens of the state in Northwest Louisiana, because we have the Feiswater Cancer Institute that has the ability to really engage in precision medicine, as well as different departments such as the Department of Pathology, and then also the Cardiovascular Center that has the ability to really drill down into basic principles of research, but then more importantly can help facilitate the translation of these discoveries into the clinical sector. So I think the future is looking up.
Well, thank you, Dr. Kevel, Director of the Cardiovascular Research Center here at LSU in Shreveport, as well as thank you to Dr. Andrew Yurochko with the Department of Immunology and Microbiology here at LSU as well. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us tonight on Health Matters. And as you have all heard before, Health Matters is a show for informational purposes only. For all serious health concerns, you should consult a physician or other healthcare professional. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance tonight was provided by Mr. Wally Derleth, Al Villarreal, as well as Tim Snell. Support for this program comes from the Noel Foundation, also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you for joining us this evening.